Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today.
Are you under the impression that everyone believes in the Trinity? Most denominational creeds, seminary requirements, and church statements of faith begin with a confession that there is one God who exists in three person, or some such articulation of the Trinity. Perhaps you think that this means that American pastors believe in the Trinity and they faithfully teach it to their congregations? If so, you would be wrong. Today, my guest is biblical studies scholar Dr. Dustin R. Smith of Spartanburg Methodist College in South Carolina. He presents the shocking truth based on three independent surveys about American belief in the Trinity. The results are in. Belief in the Trinity is now a minority position in the United States, both among Americans in general and among those who attend church. What is going on? What are the implications? And what does this mean for biblical Unitarians? Join me as Dr. Dustin Smith explains what's going on. Here now is episode 663, The Trinity, Now a Minority Belief in America, with Dustin Smith. Welcome to Restitutio, Dustin Smith.
Thanks for having me, Sean. I appreciate it.
To begin with, could you introduce yourself, just say a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
I'm a husband and a father of two, and I'm deeply interested in helping other people understand the Christology of the New Testament authors, of the biblical writers, and also how they understood that the true God is the Father alone. And so I've basically spent the last 10 years of my professional adult life trying to make that information accessible to people. So most people know me from the Biblical Unitarian podcast, but I've also kind of gone into scary waters of TikTok and various other places as well. So I'm just trying to help those that are misinformed or have not had access to all these tools and this information to become better informed about what the New Testament authors wanted us to understand about God and Jesus Christ, arguably the two most important people in the universe.
Yeah. You do a lot of work in taking scholarship and helping regular people understand it. And that's an important role. That's a very important role. I've met many scholars who, or come across their work, who are just incapable of communicating with normal people. I don't know how else to say that in a nicer way, but as you've done your education over the years, you have been able to retain your ability to communicate with normal, everyday folks. So that's a great advantage. Is that something that is important to you, being able to be understandable or accessible, I guess?
It's really important because I'm also a person of faith, a believing Christian, and I believe that we're called to obey Jesus and to observe his commandments and to follow after his model. So, you know, Jesus had disciples and he taught them. And I think he told us that we need to be making disciples and teaching them to observe all the things that Jesus taught. And so, of course, also being on a college campus and around 18, 19, 20 year olds helps me to keep me a little bit level-headed and at least trying to keep up with their culture, which is just constantly evolving and moving. And I do the best that I can.
Yeah. So a while back, it's actually last month, you had a podcast episode called 437, Most Biblical Scholars Reject Jesus as God. And I was just listening to that. I was like, man, I got to have Dustin on to talk about this. You talk about this conference that you attended in Italy. You took a trip to Italy. What was this conference about and how was your time there?
Yeah, I was invited to present a paper at the Enoch Seminar, and this is the 25th time that they've gotten together. The Enoch Seminar is just a scholarly guild, and every year they have a gathering of scholars to present on a particular topic. And so this year, what kind of caught my interest is that the theme of the meetings was from Jewish prophet to a Gentile God, reading Christology within Jewish messianism and monotheism. And they put quotes there around monotheism. So for people to see, those that are listening on the podcast, I offered to present a paper and my paper got accepted. And I was actually kind of surprised because everyone there is like way above me. I'm just surprised that they let me in there. Seasoned scholars, but there are some other people there kind of around my age. It was great. I enjoyed Rome and Italy. It was the most exciting trip that I've been on overseas, and I can't wait to go back again.
Yeah. What'd you think about the food? Did you get any Italian food while you were there? I'm sure you did.
A little bit. It seems like every restaurant has their pasta and their ravioli and lasagna and everything. Yeah. But every restaurant also has like their own special thing too. So
yeah,
it was good. Their pasta is a lot better than it is in America, I can tell you
that. It sure is. I was shocked at how good it is because I'm not really a pasta guy, but man, in Rome, it was incredible. We ended up staying at a hotel that was walkable to the train station in downtown Rome. And like probably in most cities, this is the case. Like anywhere you can easily walk to from like the downtown train station is not a great part of the city. But we found the most amazing food there. So it worked out.
Yeah.
Each restaurant had their own wine that they made themselves, which I thought was kind of charming too. All right, so let's talk about this informal poll. I think you said that Dan McClellan put it together.
Yeah.
A little poll about whether or not the New Testament teaches that Jesus is God. Talk about this poll and why would he even do that at this event?
Yeah, it was really interesting because the way that the conference would work is that we all got the papers ahead of time, about a month ahead of time, and the idea was that we were supposed to read them, and then, you know, kind of a summary of the paper would be presented, and then we would have like an hour to engage respectfully with the paper and with each other, and so it was really, really nice. It was super cool for that, and so after 3 days of doing that, it was interesting to see the sort of questions that kept coming up. And one of the questions that kept coming up was, what does it mean to say that Jesus is divine? Because it was very clear that everyone in the room had a different definition of what it meant for Jesus to be divine.
Ah.
And of course, if that's the case, then it doesn't really help to say, you know, do you believe in the divinity of Jesus or do you not believe? Because my question is, well, what does that mean? And it was interesting that it was actually my question about, well, it depends on what you mean by the divinity of Jesus, that actually brought about the question that Dan McClellan had asked. And so at the end of all this, we were kind of done with all the papers and stuff, and we were just kind of informally talking. And he asked this particular question. I'm just going to say it very clearly so people can understand what it is.
Yeah.
He asked, how many would agree that there are any texts in the New Testament that present Jesus as the very God of Israel, the only true God? There was probably 35 people that were there, but 25 of them were invited to present. So out of the scholars that were actually there, having presented the papers, but also having listened to the papers and had the opportunity to be swayed or persuaded or dissuaded by the papers, only six of the scholars out of 25 agreed that there are any texts in the New Testament that portray Jesus as the very God of Israel, as the only true God, six out of 25. Mm-hmm. And so that's less than 25%. It's 24% by my napkin math, which means that the majority, 76% of those scholars disagree that there are texts that portray Jesus as the very God of Israel.
Right. These are just not generic scholars. These are people that are specialists in Christology.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these are people who are trained and are thinking and reading and writing in this field of Christology. And the majority of them are saying, yeah, the New Testament doesn't say that. It's kind of weird that we even have to ask that question, right? like for Moby Dick, we wouldn't be like, well, was Ahab, like you could make a judgment, like was Ahab a good captain or a bad captain? Sure, you could say that, but like, you know, was Ahab the captain of the boat? Like that's not, that's not complicated, but I suppose it is something that we do need to ask, especially today. What would you say struck you as far as the significance of that? Like, did you find out the results right away or later on? And what was the, you know,
no,
what was your reaction?
Like, we were in a room and it was like, raise your hand if you agree with this.
Okay.
That's how it was like.
So it's just like a very open poll.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Something else you mentioned in your previous podcast is that no one was allowed to record.
Right.
So there was a sense of safety for people to be a little more honest. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So nobody was recording the sessions. Nobody was videotaping anything. And so maybe somebody would put their job at risk if back home, they found out that they raised their hand or didn't raise their hand. But there was like a sense of like, okay, here in Italy, we're in Italy. What happens in Italy stays in Italy.
Yeah. Dan made a video later where he was talking about the very same question, coincidentally, along the same time that I was doing this as well, because it was very interesting for him. It was something that he was trying to gather this data to try to understand, you know, what do most biblical scholars think on a variety of topics. And so he was asking these questions throughout the week. It was kind of interesting. But yeah, there was definitely a sense in which, you know, we wanted everyone to be honest. We wanted everyone to be open and to be transparent about things. And even when we disagreed, you know, it was all very respectful. People were listening to each other. It was nice.
All right. So this is one piece of data.
Sure.
Talk about this other poll, George Barna poll from April 2025. I came across it online. It says, most Americans, including most Christian churchgoers, reject the Trinity. Tell us about this poll and the results.
Yeah, so George Barna is very famous. He's been doing these polls for a long time, and he's been praised for the rigorous aspects of his polls and how objective he is. And so this, just last year, 2025, okay? And so he surveyed over 2,000 people. They were Americans. And out of his survey, only 11% of American adults believed in the doctrine of the Trinity. And he was able to break it down into a bunch of other different subcategories. Like for those that were self-professed Christians, that were Christian American adults, it was only 16%, and that's one out of six. And then he has other categories as well. If they were identified as a born-again Christian, it would be 24%, so like one out of four. If they attended a Protestant church, it was 20%, so that's one out of five. If they attended a Catholic church, surprisingly, it was actually only 9%. That was kind of the lowest group right there. But out of all those, it's very clear that the title of his results is correct. Most Christians, including Christian churchgoers, reject the Trinity in the year 2025.
This is just absolutely front page news, in my opinion. Absolutely front page news.
Yeah. Believers in the Trinity are in the minority in America.
Like every time you say it, I'm just like, is that really true? Like, it's so incredible. Like, I have my suspicions, you know, and I have like anecdotal data because my mom had grown up Southern Baptist in Southern Ohio and Virginia, North Carolina, you know, so, you know, a lot of strong Christians there. And she never believed in the Trinity. When she was first approached by somebody who questioned her on this, she's like, yeah, I don't believe in that. She's like, yes, you do. You're an evangelical. Like, come on. And she's like, no, I never learned. I really don't know what you're talking about. You know, what is this three in one, three person? Why are you calling God a person? She just didn't get it. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, that's one data point. But when we look at these surveys, we're talking about thousands of people. We're talking about rigorous statistical methodology by professionals. Like George Barna, the company, is absolutely top level as far as like their methodology, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's huge. And then you also talked about this other one. I think it was Ligonier, which was the ministry of R.C. Sproul, State of Theology Survey from September of 2025. What did they find?
Yeah, it's interesting. We get two polls on this question in the year 2025. And so it was really, really fun to publish those results. And so this poll was actually far more extensive. They surveyed over 3,000 people.
Wow.
And they would ask various questions about what do you believe about the Father? What do you believe about the Son? What do you believe about the Holy Spirit? And of course, you had to, in order to be qualified as an authentic Trinitarian, you have to agree with a bunch of propositions on all of these different things. So it's not like, do you believe in the Trinity or do you not believe in the Trinity? You know, they found that's not helpful. They ask questions, do you believe something specific about the Father, about the Son, and about the Spirit, and about the three of them?
So you had to have multiple yeses in order for that to qualify as like a possible Trinitarian. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really smart. Yeah.
So they would ask questions like, do you believe that God is three persons? And they would, you know, do you strongly agree, neutral, somewhat disagree, or strongly disagree? Do you believe that Jesus is God? Do you believe that the Spirit is a personal being? And of course, you had to answer yes to all these questions. Those are just a few of them. But out of those that answered yes to all the questions that are required to be a Trinitarian, it turned out that it was only like one in four people. It was like roughly 25%. I think I'm actually rounding up there. based on my math.
Okay.
Yeah, 25% of the 3,000 surveyed knew enough of the correct answers to claim to believe in what it takes to be an authentic Trinitarian.
Wow. That's just incredible. Now, contrast that with the Unitarian Christian Alliance data for membership.
Yeah, and I need to go look and see what it looks like now in July. I took, in that episode that you were talking about, I took what was given at a presentation. I think it was one of the New Zealand presentations.
Okay.
But it just showed that there was just a steady increase over every single month of people that are identifying as Unitarians. They understand that the true God is the Father alone, and that Jesus is the human Messiah, the Son of God, the Christ. And more and more and more people are coming to that understanding. Mm-hmm. And yet what's interesting is that we, out of all of these different surveys, whether it's just anecdotal or official surveys, fewer and fewer people are confessing belief and understanding in the doctrine of the Trinity.
What does this mean? What do you think?
I can just kind of give you some guesses.
Yeah, I guess none of us really knows for sure, but
yeah,
I'm just thinking about it. I'm like, does that mean we're winning? Sorry, go ahead.
I tell you, when it's always interesting to see what the Orthodox people say in regard to those polls that came out. And they said two things in particular that I'm going to repeat right here, and then I'm going to give you my third point.
Yeah.
The first one is that they don't think the pastors and the churches understand the Trinity. And so if a pastor doesn't even understand what the doctrine is, then how in the world is he going to be able to teach it to his congregants, okay? I get it. So that was their first point. The other thing is that they don't think that the pastors in the churches, they don't think that those pastors value the Trinity enough in importance in order to teach it. They don't think it's important enough to teach. There are so many other things they could be teaching or preaching about or making a big point on, but either they don't understand it or they don't understand it and they don't think it's important enough to teach. So that was kind of their side's understanding of it. But I think there's a third point. I think there's another thing. It's that we do know that more and more people are reading their Bibles. More and more people are actually buying Bibles, and Bible sales are actually continuing to rise. Actually, in the last 5 years, it just continued to get higher and higher and higher. So more people are reading their Bibles, and they are seeing that God and Jesus are distinct persons. And of course, we have a variety of ministries, Your Good Ministry, the UCA, and others that are doing their best to make this information available to people that, you know, the true God is the Father alone. Jesus is a human being. He's the Messiah. He has a God above him. The God of Jesus is the Father alone, only one person. And so I think there's a combination of all these things. And like for me, it's very exciting because I feel like, I mean, you look back in the last 20 years, we have so much momentum right now. There's so much that's going on right now. I mean, to me, what I tell people is I'm like, put the pedal to the floor.
Yeah.
Keep pushing. Keep grinding because they're scared. They're panicking. They're running. They're disengaging us from debates because I feel like the information now is out there anymore. It's not being held by, you know, a 15th century, 16th century church from people that can't read or write and don't have the internet and don't have AI to look
well,
these
and, things
up.
AI is huge too, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's trolling the web and it doesn't know that it's supposed to deplatform biblical Unitarians.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's referring people to your work, to my work, to other people's work all the time. And for better or for worse, BUs, biblical Unitarians, are kind of a loud crew. You know, we've got our websites and we are putting out stuff all the time. We're proud of our beliefs and we're trying to tell others about it. And so there are just like so many websites in different languages, YouTube channels, podcasts, whatever. It is getting out there. And I think AI is actually like helping us to some degree. What an exciting time. Now, what would you say to somebody who says, well, I'm a little embarrassed. I don't want anyone to know that I don't believe in the Trinity. What about that kind of person?
There is a kind of a sense of this Stockholm syndrome or this persecuted complex where you feel like, well, you think that you're in the minority because you're told that this is what everyone believes. But the point is, that's not true. It's not true. Belief in the Trinity is the minority position by far in the United States.
Honestly, okay? I just want you to say that again.
A belief in the Trinity is the minority position in the United States.
Oh, it sounds, every time you say it, I just get, It's like in The Lion King, we said, Mufasa, ooh, say it again. I love that. Belief in the Trinity is a minority position. So people are saying, oh, well, I don't want anyone to know that I don't believe in this. I'm scared or whatever. You say, well, look, it's already a minority position. Wow. So like either we're winning or they're losing. Either way, the net result is fewer people holding to this idea. Now, let's now shift to your work with your YouTube channel and the Biblical Unitarian Podcast. You know, this is something you've been focusing on really from the beginning of starting this podcast. It's all in the name, right? Biblical Unitarian Podcast. So why did you like initially say, okay, well, I'm just going to focus on this one issue? Comment a little bit about how that's gone for you over the years.
Yeah. And I think at that point you had already had your Restitutio work going on. So I've been doing it for about 9 years now, just kind of every single week. I publish something on Thursdays, you know, 442 weeks in a row now. Nice. And when I initially started it 9 years ago, I was looking online and I went to, it was either like iTunes or some sort of podcast program. And I typed in Unitarian or Biblical Unitarian and it would say no results. Mm. I'm like, this is crazy. Like nothing, like we don't have any sort of voice out here in podcast. And you know, that was when podcasts started to pick up. I'm like, well, let me fill this void. Let me at least provide any, at least give them something to listen to. And I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I'm just kind of inventing it as I go along and I've learned a lot. And, you know, I'll go back and listen to old episodes and those are embarrassing. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, I was a kid, you know, like we've moved on. We've learned some things. You know, I've had some good wise counsel saying, hey, you should put the mic right here and not way over there and, you know, work on your editing skills and speak more clearly and that sort of stuff. So I was trying to provide something that wasn't there. And one of the things that I've realized is that people are interested in these topics. And I actually am still convinced that despite all of the momentum that we have right now, there are still more people out there that actually are implicit Unitarian readers of the Bible. And they just don't know there's a thing called Biblical Unitarianism. And they're like, well, that's what I believe because that's what I read in the Bible. They don't know there's a larger movement or these churches or these denominations. And I still feel like there's more work that could be done to get this information out there to the world. We haven't reached our ceiling yet.
Let me ask you about debates for a second, because you spanked James White. Let's just go ahead and say that. I enjoyed that debate. Would you say that debates are like really helpful to get the word out or not as much as
go ahead. If you can market it the right way, it's good. I think one of the benefits for me in that debate was that it was in person. And it was one of the earlier debates in the weekend. Mm-hmm. And so afterwards, I was able, I didn't have any time to myself. I had people coming up and ask me like, hey, what do you think about this? And I was able to network with people and to exchange email addresses and to talk to people and to just kind of like promote my brand and the work that I'm doing and my podcast. And I had a lot of people sign up and subscribe, you know, just by interacting with that. And then, you know, I had, you know, good people that took a lot of the clips and they just ran with them. You know, Mike did some really, really good stuff with that. And that was really, really helpful. And then all the time now I'm on TikTok and they're like, oh, we know you. You're the guy that debated James White. Like I run into people and they know me, but I've never met them. I don't know who they are. So it was good. So I think if you have a debate that you can actually take and actually get out in front of other people, that's helpful because that can actually change hearts and minds and persuade people. But it's hard to tell. I mean, like, debates are a dime a dozen these days. I mean, there's one going on every day, I imagine.
Yeah, I just so enjoyed that debate. I enjoyed the other one you did with Sam Nisan and what was the other guy? Will Barlow, Sam Nisan, and the other fellow. What I loved about that one was your conclusion, because like everyone was so chummy, and then like at the very end, you're like, I raised all these points, you didn't answer any, we win, and I was like, yeah. Get him. You kind of did that with the James White debate too, where you just like put this scoreboard up, which obviously, you know, that's a rhetorical flourish, but it's also a sad fact. Two sad facts. One, that he didn't engage with any of your points. I mean, that's awful. Let's think about that for a moment. Like the point of a debate is to, you know, raise points and then the other person to like engage, you know, maybe you can't refute them all in the moment, but like just engage a little bit. But also the second sad fact is that you predicted he wouldn't do that because you had to prepare the slides ahead of time. And then he did what you predicted.
Yeah. Yep.
So what was that like in the moment? You're like, well, I guess it's good that he didn't engage my points because now I can use these slides.
No, and my closing, I'm reading from a script.
Yeah.
So
he did exactly what you thought he would do.
Well, I mean, I overprepared for that debate. I mean, I had like 100 hours of prep time on it. And I watched every debate that he did over the last 10 years multiple times, took tons of notes. I knew all the texts that he typically brings up, and I had written answers for all of them. And I asked questions that I knew that he wouldn't be able to answer. Like, you know, you have to think about it kind of like, okay, based on a particular person, how would they potentially respond to this? And all of it's just guesswork and stuff like that. But yeah, I pick things and he wouldn't engage with it. And you have to remind people that in a debate, it's not just about cross-examination. I know that's what gets clipped and that's what people like to listen to and stuff like that. But the burden of proof was on him. He took the affirmative. The debate was on, does the Bible teach the Trinity?
Yeah.
And he didn't demonstrate that point, not even close. In fact, in his opening statement, he said that the Trinity was just kind of assumed by the biblical authors. So it doesn't teach it. It's just kind of assumed that's there. Well, I think that's begging the question a little bit.
Absolutely.
A lot.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he accuses biblical Unitarians of doing, is presupposing Unitarianism, right? But that's what he's doing. He's accusing us of what he's doing, which is, you know, I think a standard but sad technique.
The young kids call that gaslighting.
Gaslighting, there it is.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your channel on YouTube. It's grown immensely over the last couple of years. You've now got nearly 55,000 subscribers. What's going on here? Like, where do you think this growth is coming from? What are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, the best thing that I've found is just to get my name out there, because like 10 years ago, I was a nobody. I mean, nobody knew who I was. I mean, I had like one published book, but everyone can publish a book these days, you know, and I'm a recent graduate. Yeah, but anyone can do that. But I just had to get myself out there, and you keep making content over and over. But I noticed that for some people, it's like when they want to have Bible discussions with people, they want to debate on things they disagree with. But I've found it's actually a better approach. If I'm meeting somebody, let's find something we have in common. Let's connect on that. And then, you know what, once we've built a relationship, then we can go back and we can talk about things that we see things a little bit differently. So I try to approach and try to meet lots of different people, and I'll try to connect on things that we see eye to eye on. And I just find that I make a lot more friends that way than just kind of going for the jugular on things that we disagree with. So networking is a huge deal. I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 months on TikTok, which for some people they just didn't want to do. And I was hesitant about it quite a bit, but that's a whole another age group of people who they're very much interested in the Bible. There's a big Bible debating community there on TikTok, you know, ages between 15 and 40. And so I've been able to connect with a lot of people there that otherwise wouldn't have watched, you know, cause they don't get on Facebook, you know, Facebook's for old people. That's what
I think. Yep.
So just kind of connecting again with the next generation. Another thing that I do is that I record my classes. I mean, you have lots of classes on your channel, and I take those classes and I upload them to my channel, but I put them as like private. So like, you know, a subscriber won't be able to see those classes, but there are classes that are there and only the people that have access to it are there. So while they're actually looking at the classes, they're also looking at, you know, the other videos, the things that come up at the end. You know, I teach Greek and New Testament basically every semester. So I constantly have a whole bunch of new students that are coming in there. So it's just finding all sorts of different ways to point people towards the channel. And then, you know, just kind of let them use their God-given free will to decide, do they want to keep watching more, or do they want to subscribe, or do they want to inquire, or whatever it may be. But it's not been an overnight thing. I didn't even get any substantial growth until really the last 3 years. And that's when I started with YouTube Shorts. So...
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Very good. Well, I think it's good news. It's good news to see so many people interested in the topic. You know, it's really gone from something that I think a lot of people were ashamed of and embarrassed of to like really embracing the U word, for example. You know, like a lot of people don't want to use the word Unitarian because of the Unitarian Universalists. They're just a bunch of liberals, some of them not even Christian at all. You know, over time, we added that B to the beginning of it, biblical Unitarian, and you were really like the early adopter to just like own that phrase, biblical Unitarian. Not that you invented it, but like you really just were like, you know what, I'm just going to go with this. it's really shown out in the results that that's actually a good strategy, not to be like shy about it, but to be upfront about it. And then, you know, your initial impulse was to be findable. So as people type in the U word into search engines and now into chatbots for AI, everyone's going to come across your work because like you were just like there early and you have been consistent and you are on all these different platforms now. So that's really cool.
Well, we couldn't predict that. I mean, we had no idea what AI was going to look like 10 years ago, but you know, I think it's important to lead with your truths and to be proud of what you believe and don't portray yourself as like, you know, I'm anti-Trinitarian. You know, like that's, you don't want to be against something. You want to be for something. You want to be pro something. You want to be, again, leading with the things that are super important. And, you know, what's more important than the God of the universe? I can't think of too many things, you know, more important than that. So it's a great topic. And, you know, immediately I am able to make friends with Jews and Muslims, and we can connect with that. And we can have those conversations. And, you know, again, it's just about leading and networking and relationships and, you know, doing the best you can with that.
So you have 442 episodes out so far. Are you worried you're going to run out of content?
Oh, man. I have a Google Doc of like all these potential podcast like ideas and episodes and stuff like that. And I don't know. I think I'm good for like probably the rest of the year. I think, but I come up with new things all the time. You know, you engage with people and you talk with people and you think, okay, well, I think that this argument should be really convincing, but I find out that maybe it's not. So maybe I need to kind of shore up some of that argument, or I need to address things. Or if you're on social media, you'll see videos that come up and you're like, okay, well, I need to answer this, or maybe we need to have an answer for this. Or maybe you probably get this as well, where, you know, well, what do you think about John 17:5? What do you think about Isaiah 9:6? And then you're like, okay, well, at least for you, I mean, you did a whole presentation on Isaiah 9:6. You could be like, okay, well, I'll just point you to that. So sometimes I just get the question so often, you know, what do you think about John 1:1? You just want to have a video. You want to have something there. So like, okay, if you ask the question, hey, I put something comprehensive together, go and listen to this and then come back and let's ask some questions. So providing resources for people and also things that people can share and give to other people if they're trying to evangelize and to, you know, participate in biblical Unitarian evangelism. I think giving them resources, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, for sure. What are you encouraged by in the biblical Unitarian world? What do you see out there happening that you're like, you know, this is good? I mean, obviously we talked about the stats and, you know, Trinitarianism is on the decline, whereas at least in some corners, Unitarian Christianity seems to be growing or at least becoming more connected and visible. What else are you encouraged by?
It's interesting. I kind of look back on my theological upbringing and, you know, we would be reading reference books or reading commentaries and you're like, yo, oh, you know, they're going to interpret it, you know, kind of like a high Christological view. And you knew which books were good and you knew which books were bad. But one of the things that I've kind of seen really over the last 20 years is that it's very rare when actually you'll find like a biblical commentary that's saying the early Christians were Trinitarians. Like, That's pretty rare these days. Like most people know better to come out and say something as ludicrous as that, with all due respect. And so one of the things that I'm finding is that more and more scholars are being open about, hey, the early Christians, they were subordinationists, okay? They didn't think that Jesus was equal with God, that, you know, Nicaea and Chalcedon were developments from what the early Christians believed. That's pretty common nowadays. And so I feel like some scholars, of course, are going to be denominationally handcuffed and they can't say that kind of stuff at that point. And those you're always going to have those works. That's never going to change. But for others, I think you can find that there's a scholarly awareness and an openness now to be honest about these things, be honest about the fact that the early Christians understood that the true God was the Father alone. They didn't understand the Spirit as a separate person alongside the Father, that Jesus was a human person that was given divine unending life at his resurrection. Mm-hmm. You know, the access that we actually have now to the writings of the second, third, fourth century Christians that are now available. Before, you'd have to go get these big, massive books, but now you can just get it online for free. So it's that information is now being accessible to people. So
And you can actually just ask the AI, just be like, hey, what did Origen say about this? Provide source quotations.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, things yeah. are just yeah. totally accessible in a way that they never were before.
Yeah.
That's an encouragement. Anything else on the, among like biblical Unitarians ourselves, like that you've seen that's been encouraging?
Just you're constantly meeting more people. Like I
said, yeah, you are traveling more, right?
Yeah. And it's, I think it's, I had the opportunity to do that. And I like those privileges to be able to travel and to meet people. And that's part of the networking that just has to be done. But again, I'm still convinced that there are more people out there that if we just showed them this framework, they would say, yeah, that makes sense. Sign me up. Okay. So I think, again, we've got all this momentum and you know, the gatekeepers, they can't shut off the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only way they can do it. The only way they can try to do this is to control the information, but they can't do that anymore because anyone can go to AI or to YouTube and ask, you know, did the early Christians believe in the Trinity? You know, what did they believe about Jesus? You know, yeah. is the gospel John Trinitarian? And they're going to find all sorts of good videos that are helping them out now. And we didn't have that 20 years ago. We didn't have all these resources. We had a couple of books. Okay. But I mean, when I think in one of your last presentations, I think it was last year, you had pointed out like all the different publications that have come out just recently, you know, and we're not even done. We've got all sorts of things that are still,
no, we're just warming up
the pipelines. Oh yeah. We're like I said, we've got so much momentum right now. It is an exciting time to be a biblical Unitarian. There's no reason why people need to be ashamed. They've got the momentum behind them and they need to be courageous. And I think whatever we can do to encourage people to be brave and to share their faith, I think that's an authentic marker of a Christian, as someone that is steadfast in their ability to preach the message and to preach the truth, even in the midst of opposition.
If you were to change one thing, if you could snap your fingers and change one thing among the biblical Unitarian world, what would it be?
Oh, that's easy. I would say that they all need to join a biblical Unitarian church. If you're a biblical Unitarian and you don't have a Unitarian church, you really need to seriously consider relocating. If your job allows you to do that and your family allows you to do that, or start your own. Okay. But we shouldn't be isolated. We need to gather together because we need your input. We need your gifts in the church. And of course we need to come together. And if we're more organized, we're going to be more effective. So that's the one thing I would change, is that for the isolated Unitarians to be a part of their own believing community of faith.
Yeah. And you're leading by example. You're part of a church, and being part of any church is going to have some benefits, but it's also going to have some annoyances and some difficulties. Let's face it, it's easy to just be on your own and just have everything on your terms. But there are a lot of growth opportunities that happen when you have to deal with people. You're leading by example there. Let's talk about what projects you're currently working on. What can you tell us about? What's in the pipeline? Of course, you have this event where you're going to be in the London area presenting. Can you tell us about that and then anything else?
Yeah, that's the third annual UK UCA conference. And I'll be talking about the Christology of the Book of Revelation and how Jesus, or in particular the Lamb, functions as the agent of the one seated upon the throne.
Yeah.
So that'll come out there. As far as like writing projects, my problem now is that I just keep saying yes to everything, which is a good problem to have. So I think we're probably at a point where we can start talking about this. So there is a new press called Soterian Press, and I've been invited to write a commentary on 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. It's a 2-year project, and so you won't see it for like another 18 months or something like that, but I am slowly working on that. For a few hours every single day.
Yeah, I heard you already have a couple hundred pages done.
I've got a lot. I've got.
You're so prodigious in your output. It's incredible how you do it.
I believe in the work. I believe in and setting aside video games gives you a lot more time to do that. So
there you go. Yeah.
There's a former presenter from the UCA, Robert Kokonyesi.
Yep.
And I'm working together with him on a
Hungarian
volume
guy, right?
Yeah, we're working actually. We're trying to take the Hungarian Unitarian work of a guy named Georgi Enyedi, and to make his work available to English readers. So we're working on that. Of course, we have the edited volume by Stephen Nemesh and Keegan Chandler. I've got two essays. They tricked me into writing two essays in that, and I think you got an essay in there too.
I think I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's coming out. All the papers that we presented at the Enoch seminar will eventually get published. We're going to take the feedback that we got from the conference and kind of adjust our papers. And so that will be a big deal. And then actually just this last week, I got invited to write forwards for two different Unitarian works.
Nice.
So, cool. And then I have an online Greek class that's beginning in September for those that are.
Yeah. Go ahead and plug that so people know about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people that just want to learn, I would say the first semester of a class of Greek, I do an online class just one night a week for an hour and a half. And it's just, if you email me, kggospel@gmail.com, I can give you all the information for that. It's also up there on my channel. You could see that. So we just do one night a week on Monday nights, and we just go through a chapter. And I've been teaching this class. This would be like the 12th time I've done it. So I've gotten very, very good at it. I got a good pace for what people can learn when it comes to Greek. But I want to equip people that are interested in trying to learn and understand the New Testament with these tools so that they can dig deeper into the text and they can start to engage some scholarly works and deepen their faith by being able to read and understand and apply the text to their lives. So if you're a new person, it's completely accessible. I've had people as young as 14 years old take this Greek class, reach out to me, and I look forward to working with you.
Yeah, and Greek is just such a great tool for understanding and reading the New Testament, right? Because New Testament was written in Greek, and you hear preachers do this, where they're like, oh, well, that's really the Greek word such and such, and then, you know, most people are like, you know, over their heads, what? Yeah. well, why not become an insider? Why not become somebody who has the knowledge to read the New Testament in its original language? You know, everybody puts all this trust in translations, and translators are amazing people. And, you know, most translations are fine works. But there's always some corner here or there where their bias just like comes through, whether they realize it or not. And so like, why not get the raw, unfiltered New Testament? So I definitely encourage folks to take Dustin's class. And how much does that cost to take it?
Yeah, it's $200 for 3 months of lectures. And you get a copy of the BDAG lexicon, an ebook copy of it. So normally that's like $100 in and of itself. Mm. And you have lifetime access to all of the videos.
Awesome.
So you can go back and watch them over for the rest of your life.
Awesome. People are paying more than that for their sports packages and for all kinds of other things that are not going to have the benefits that learning how to read the New Testament in its original language would provide. So I think that's a very reasonable price. Where can people follow your work and learn more about you? Would you say pretty much the Biblical Unitarian Podcast YouTube channel, or are there other places people should look?
Yeah, primarily on the YouTube side. That's where I kind of spend most of my time. It's youtube.com/Biblical Unitarian Podcast. And now on all the videos, if you click on the description, it'll have links to everything else, whether it's Twitter, X, you know, TikTok or Instagram or whatever. I kind of dabble in those things, but I put most of my time on the YouTube stuff. And I answer emails if people want to email me. I do the best that I can. I am fairly busy, but if you engage with my work and you have a charitable question, then I'll take the time to answer that question.
And you also have books on Amazon, like A Systematic Theology of the Early Church. So that's a book that you've got out. And if somebody goes on Amazon, they can type in Dustin Smith. So they put the R as well, just to distinguish you from other Dustin Smiths. Dustin R. Smith, just to clarify which Dustin Smith. I have the same problem, but not as bad as the Smith people. The Smith people really have a lot of, you are a mighty tribe, let's just say.
There are other Dustin R. Smiths.
Oh, no.
Papers on academia.com. So
yeah,
it's a mess.
Believe it or not, yeah. I have that same problem, because for whatever reason, like out of all the Finnegans, Sean Finnegan is like a very common combo. And then I'm like, all right, now Sean P. Finnegan. And yeah, we all have P as the middle name too. So I feel your pain. But Systematic Theology of the Early Church. You've got Wisdom Christology in the Gospel of John. What else do you have on Amazon that people could get?
Yeah, I did like 10 years ago, we did a Three Views book called The Son of God, Three Views of the Identity of Jesus.
And you got a Revelation book too, right? Paradoxical Conquering.
Yeah, that's just a copy of my dissertation. I probably changed my mind on some of that stuff since then.
Okay. And follow Dustin on YouTube. And how do they find you on TikTok if they're a TikToker?
It's called a Biblical Unitarian Podcast.
Oh, okay. Just TikTok, so that's easy.
Again, there you lead with the title.
There it is.
I know. I don't use my name. I just use my title. So
there you go.
But my picture's there. You'll see it.
Yep. All right. Anything else we should cover?
No, just grateful that you had me on. Nice to catch up with you as always. I appreciate the good work that you're doing. If people aren't already following Sean, you need to hit that subscribe button right now.
Please do.
And grab your spouse's phone and go on to their YouTube and click subscribe on their phone as well.
So that's the secret, huh? The twofer.
That's two for one.
Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Well, that draws our interview to a close. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 663, The Trinity Now, A Minority Belief in America with Dustin Smith, and leave your feedback there. On last week's episode 662, The Nicene Creed is a Forgery with Sam Tiedemann, we have received a ton of comments on the YouTube channel, including Kenner33, who said, "You have hinted toward this for a while, Sam. Looking forward to this one." And Roger Dewberry saying, "Fascinating." And Andre Aurelius saying, "What kind of bull shit is this? The Nicene Creed is as real as the Constitution." My goodness. Don't you just love the comments that come in from people who don't actually listen to the episode? Sam did not make a case that there is no Nicene Creed. His case is that the Nicene Creed was forged. And what he means by forged is that, first of all, it did not exist at Nicaea. And the standard consensus that it was actually formulated or adopted or ratified at Constantinople in 381 is also false. It was actually not brought in as an official declaration of the church until 451, and it was brought in under a forged circumstance. In other words, it was said to be something it was not. So we're not saying that it doesn't exist. We're not saying that churches don't recite it all over the world. We're just saying that it's not from Nicaea, and it's not from Constantinople. And saying it was at Constantinople is lying. So that's where the forgery aspect comes in. Someone using the name "What Your Pastor Didn't Tell You" wrote, "Good video and a lot of important points. At around 1430, Sam says that the formal language Trinitarians use now is in direct contradiction to the canons of the Council of Nicaea. But I don't think that's technically correct. What I think he is referring to is that the Greek words that Nicaea used is the same Greek words that modern Trinitarian language is based on, but obviously in English. As Sam knows, modern Trinitarians are using English theological terms, person, being, substance, that map onto the Cappadocian use of 381, not the Nicene usage of 325. The apparent contradiction only arises if you assume the English word person corresponds to the Greek word hypostasis, as it was used at Nicaea, but it doesn't. In 325, hypostasis meant something like individual concrete reality, and essentially synonymous with ousia. If I could just jump in right here, I would say that hypostasis typically just means nature, as it's used in the New Testament. But then, owing to pressure from the Trinitarian controversy, changed meanings to mean person later on. This commenter continues, "In 381, hypostasis was redefined to mean person." Okay, that's what I just said. He goes on, "Modern Trinitarian language follows the 381 definitions, not the 325 definitions, so there is no doctrinal contradiction, only a shift in terminology. In other words, Sam is saying Trinitarians use the English words based on the Greek words, but the same Greek words at Nicaea contradict with the Greek words that modern Trinitarians base their usage off of. The problem, of course, with this phrasing is that saying Greek words are used differently doesn't really mean much because everyone admits that the meaning of Greek words changed over time." Yes, well, thank you for that nuance there. I don't think Sam would disagree with you on that. Signs in the Dust wrote in saying, "Sam is fortunate that he is irrelevant. Otherwise, anyone with even a modest competence in historical research would make short work of claims so grotesquely ignorant that one is left wondering whether they arise from culpable dishonesty or sheer intellectual derangement. My, my, my. It's good to see that the old ad hominem attack is still alive and kicking in the YouTubosphere. But as ever, this form of attack and critique is by far the least effective, because instead of engaging with the argument and trying to deal with the facts that Sam presented, you just insult Sam for being irrelevant and intellectually deranged. So what are you going to do? Someone named Life Here and Beyond wrote in saying, the title of the video is a clickbait. Kind of misleading, LOL. The Nicene Creed is a forgery. There should be a question mark at the end. The so-called development of the doctrine of the Trinity seems akin to the development of RCC dogmas such as the Immaculate Conception, Assumption of Mary, and papal infallibility. Catholics would say something like, the seeds of the Trinitarian doctrine and biblical Christology were in the faith from the time of the apostles down through the centuries until they were fully developed. So I definitely want to come clean on this. The title totally is clickbait. I'm just going to go ahead and own that. Sam did not come up with the title, The Nicene Creed is a Forgery. That was all me. Really, the point of the conversation we had last week in that episode was to discuss whether or not the Trinitarian Creed, typically known as the Nicene Creed, was spoken at the Council of Constantinople in 381, like most conservative Christian church history textbooks would say, and most pastors have been taught in seminary. This is an articulation of the doctrine of the Trinity that happened in the year 381. That's really what the episode was about. But since the statement, the confession or creed that we're referring to in this episode is commonly known today as the Nicene Creed, it seemed like pretty easy to put together that actually, yes, the Nicene Creed is a forgery. And again, what we mean by forgery is not to say that it's not real. It's just that it's not from Nicaea and it's not from Constantinople. It's not from those two councils. Okay. It's a later development. And it was forged. It was falsely reported to have been a statement of the church when it wasn't a statement of the church. And this is something that we see from time to time, where the early Christians in the 5th century in particular will look back and say, oh, well, this is the way it has always been. But it has not always been that way. They're just saying that because they're cherry picking from the past different things and saying, this is the ruling of the church, this is the majority, or this is what has always been. And it's not true. And it's also not hard to demonstrate that it's not true. So yes, totally guilty of a clickbait title, but that's the world we live in today. If you don't have a clickbait title, guess what? You're going to get ignored. And I'm happy to say that at least on YouTube, this video has been getting quite a few plays, and also on the audio podcast, a ton of downloads there too. Which brings me to my next point. If you enjoy this podcast with Dustin Smith today, please share it with your friends. Post it on social media. Let people know about it so that others can hear and others can engage with the points that are being brought up. Yolson Helper said, thank you, gentlemen. So far as I have been able to research the documents to this, I do not arrive at the same conclusions you do, but I do appreciate the conversation. Well, that's your prerogative. You don't have to accept the conclusions, but I don't think Sam really inferred or developed beyond the facts of the matter. The whole point of the episode was that he merely laid out the facts of the matter. Nobody said the Nicene Creed at the Council of Constantinople in 381. They did say it at the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And the question is, well, where did they get it from? And Sam laid out some theories as to where they might have gotten it from. And he was very clear that these are speculations. But holding the speculations to the side, just because we don't know where they got it from, we do know that they smuggled it in as if it had been the standard language of the ecumenical councils previous, and it was not. So that's the forgery aspect of what he's saying. Sleeks 4 wrote in, "Bravo, Sam and Sean. My own historical research led me to similar conclusions as I found the same source documentation or lack thereof. It's amazing how much confessional scholarship / apologetics tries to hide these very embarrassing facts." Thank you. Well, that's really the point of the episode, isn't it? The point of the episode is to show the facts of the matter, that the apologists and the people writing the church history textbooks are not telling you. Kodo Kanshi'ai wrote in saying, "Epiphanius recites it almost word for word years before Constantinople in 381 because it was oral tradition." Sure. That's something that Sam brought out. I think he said from the year 374, Epiphanius wrote a letter which included a very similar version to what we call today the Nicene Creed. His point was not that it didn't exist. His point is that it wasn't adopted in an ecumenical council until 451. And then it was adopted under false pretenses, as if it were previously a definitional statement of the church, when in fact it was not. I mean, he admitted that certain churches here and there might have already been using it. That's entirely possible, but that's a far cry from the official doctrine of the majority of churches, which is really what an ecumenical council is supposed to be. Mr. Seaman321 wrote in saying, "Wow, very interesting. Our God is not a God of confusion." Well, you're quoting from the Apostle Paul there, I believe, 1 Corinthians 14, "God is not a God of confusion." And certainly these people were confused as they were, as we're marching through the 4th century into the 5th century. There's a lot of confusion. Obi Todd Kenobi said, "This is blasphemy. The creed was needed and was created by the Orthodox Church to stop Arianism and from other blasphemies. What it says is exactly what the ancient church fathers believed." Yeah, but when? When are we talking about? Because we're not talking about a Nicaea in 325. We're talking about a Chalcedon 451. And that's a world of difference. That's over a century later. And so, I realize if you're Orthodox, you have to accept all the updates of the church as they roll them out, just like Microsoft Windows users have to accept all the updates one after the other, whether you like it or not. A lot of us here at Restitudio are restorationists, and we're not interested in the updates. What we're interested in is the source code. What is the original version of the apostles, and how do we get back to that apart from all of the additions and elaborations and later developments? Ministry of Truth wrote in, "Wow, apparently Mike Winger and Wes Huff must have got their information from some fringe book is now considered scholarship. I have no respect for Unitarians. It's a dishonest desire from the beginning." Well, in response to that, that's not what I said. What I said is that the typical book that evangelicals use when they study church history is Justo Gonzalez's The Story of Christianity. I don't know for sure if Mike Winger and Wes Huff used that book or if their seminaries used it, but it's pretty standard among evangelicals. And my point in referring to that book is to say that most of the controversies have been removed from it, and what remains is a very sanitized version of the events. And I invite you to go get his book and read it and compare it against Early Christianity by Joseph Lynch, which is a much better textbook that is much more honest about church history, or other textbooks that are even more recent than that. My point is simply that if the textbooks themselves don't teach the controversy, then people don't know that it really was a controversy. Instead, they have a totally false view of what happened historically. And when you say, "I have no respect for Unitarians," that really just tells us that you have a problem. I don't have a dishonest desire. You can say, "Oh, you have a dishonest desire from the beginning." No, it's not a dishonest desire. I want the truth. If looking back into the New Testament itself, I found the Trinity, I would not be denying it. I would not be questioning the history of it. What instead I find is Jesus saying the Father is greater than I. What I find Jesus saying is the Father is the only true God. What I see is scriptures that say Jesus was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. What I see Jesus saying is, I do not know the day and the hour. Only the Father knows, not even the angels or the Son. So this is not dishonest anything. This is a honest heart seeking truth wherever it leads. And believe me, I would much rather be a Trinitarian. Not because I love the doctrine or think it's really great or anything, but because it would just be a much easier world to live in when it's such a dominating view among Christians today. And I would have much more opportunity and influence, but also a much easier career and much less persecution. So it's not a dishonest desire at all. And I can speak for Sam as well. I know that he too has suffered a great deal, including being kicked out of multiple churches by intolerant, persecuting Trinitarians with whom he was happy to be at peace. And they said, no, get out of here. So that's the situation today. And it's a sad situation. And it's a situation we're hoping to change. Luke wrote in saying, the Unitarian cope is something else, despite their atonement theory making no sense and their human Messiah being unable to save them from anything. Well, there isn't one Unitarian atonement theory, just like there's not a Trinitarian atonement theory. There are lots of atonement theories on both sides of the fence. The main difference being Unitarians don't recognize that God died for our sins. We believe that instead Jesus, the human, died for our sins. And that's a whole interesting topic to discuss and compare and contrast. But on the Trinitarian side, the idea is that no mere man could ever pay for our sins. God himself had to come down and do it. But here's the problem. On Trinitarianism, God himself doesn't die for our sins. God assumes a human nature, and that impersonal human nature is what died. And so God soldiers on through the 3 days in the tomb. He never dies. God the Son never dies. He, maybe you could say, experiences a human death, by which we mean the human nature itself dies and then comes back to life after 3 days. But that's much, much less significant than a whole person dying, as Unitarians see it, with our approach to atonement. So I think there's actually much higher value on the atonement from a Unitarian perspective than a Trinitarian one. Username Acts24.5 said, amazing work. Book. I will send you my notes, as I do have some data on some issues regarding the Holy Spirit that you have not shared here. I had asked Sam about if he would be turning this into a book, and he, I don't know if you noticed this, but he just declined to answer that question. So maybe there'll be a book, maybe not. But that's all the time I have for comments for today. If any of you would like to get on the Restitutio YouTube channel and find the Nicene Creed is a Forgery with Sam Tiedemann and leave your comments there, I'm sure it would be great to have more voices in there that are less antagonistic. So far, this video has well over 1,000 views and it keeps going. So we obviously tapped into a nerve, and hopefully today's video as well will also do likewise, and more people will come to consider these subjects, which are very important. All right, well, that's going to be it for today. If you'd like to support us, you can share this episode with others, either on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube, or you can just go to the website, restitutio.org, and find today's episode, which is 663. If you'd like to support us financially, you can do that on the website, restitutio.org. There's a donation button to allow you to make a monthly recurring contribution, which would be so appreciated. I'll catch you next week, and remember, the truth has nothing to fear.